to the Pink Flyer.
David Gilmour, guitariste et chef de Pink Floyd, avec Rick Wright, organiste, Roger Waters, bassiste, et Nick Mason, batteur.
If I can remember what it was that we were going to play next, I'd tell you, but I can't.
So, we've gone through...
Is it still working, by the way?
Yeah, it's still working. It's on your scarf there.
Oh, yeah, of course.
So, we've gone through 1967 and 1968. Now we're on to 1969.
Okay.
And your first gig in 1969 was the Dome in Brighton on the 16th of June. Azimuth coordinator.
Oh,
Man
yeah,
and
yeah.
The Journey.
Oh, now that's something I taped, isn't it?
It certainly is. And I'm not sure, I think you're not the only person to have taped it. I think Bobby taped that as well.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Because I think you both caught part of the show.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And I discovered that when I was trying to work out what on earth was going on.
Oh, right, okay. Unless it was it, he duplicated it.
No, different recordings. Different recordings of the same thing. No. So did Bobby record audio at concerts, or were you the only one who did that?
It was his tape recorder.
Okay. You didn't both go to any concerts and both record?
Unless physically moved to a different position at one point.
No, not two different tape players?
No, that's a bit of a mystery.
You're only one. It feels like it's two to me. I will need to go and have another look at that.
Because he would have copied it, probably.
Yeah.
It was his recorder... Mm. That reel-to-reel, because that was the only way we could do mobile, out there. We had obviously larger recorders at home.
Yeah.
But he had this thing, which I think he got from his brother, and it was a Philips standing recorder, which had large batteries in it.
Yeah.
And they were like 20-minute tapes at a certain speed.
Three each reels.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
1 7/8 or 3 3/4 inches per second, weren't they?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And you caught that concert, and there's a bit in it where it says, "Catch the clapping, catch the clapping." Does that sound like you or Bobby?
Well, it may have been me directing, possibly. Yeah. I can remember there was like Biding My Time was on that, wasn't it? You know, that was a, and then I remember them doing Work as well. You know, where they're banging. I can't remember if I got everything that was, because it was a reasonably long evening, wasn't it?
Yeah,
and. But I also remember the actual effect as well, as how it worked in principle, you know, like how if they had footsteps, they walked all... And the Dome was quite a suitable environment there because it's circular, isn't it?
Yes, it and lends itself to
and
it.
And they had the speakers at intervals around certainly downstairs, seeing that, you know. Mm.
Did you get the sense of the sound in
the
round?
Oh, yeah, it worked very well.
Mm. You know, and you hadn't heard that before? Had you not heard that at any 67 or 68 concerts? Nothing
similar? No, that was similar. The whole big thing, wasn't it? The Azimuth coordinator. Mm. It was a big thing. Because if Floyd were pioneers in upgrading sound in general, and they must have, like I was saying earlier, like they it was impossible to hear the words and things. Mm. And they were... Are you right?
Yep. Sorry.
And I think I feel also it's because they were architects, you see, they were much more, they're more like engineers in one sense. There was obviously architects do have some artistic abilities, but they liked to everything fitted together well. And we get that in feeling, especially when once Sid had left, the Floyd came as an architect's group.
Yeah, there was a structure, wasn't it? As they
structural,
say,
even if they had a little bit apparently chaotic, it was in very much a certain niche or position, you know.
It was all
measured, if you like. Mm. But it was a bit sort of classical in approach, wasn't it? You know, I mean, this is serious, we're doing this now, and this isn't like punky. I always feel that in some ways Sid had more of a punky spirit. That's why a lot of the punks like John Lydon there actually admired Sid, because he was closer to their attitude. That's something I've observed, you know.
Yeah, he did what he wished, basically, didn't he?
Yeah, and didn't
follow the script.
Follow rules or full fools. Mm. And he
wanted it to be fun, didn't he?
And I sort of... I've agreed with that as well. As I say, with my connection, the group I was in, which were a load of anarchists, basically, you know, it was like sort of throwing yourself into something and seeing what would come out of it. It was less sort of considered, if you like, and sort of calculated in a way. Mm. But say, Floyd's strength with that, and it obviously hit the target well, was actually improving the mechanics of everything and making it more listenable and the sound quality and all of that was very important. And so the Azimuth Coordinator wasn't just a gimmick. It was quite an interesting concept, really. And it was a way of moving, you know, that's why they're important as well, because their whole approach to the sound, perception of sound or pop music or whatever, was again, a more serious level that was enduring.
Taking influence from... Across Europe, weren't they? Stockhausen and the like as well. And, you know, there'd be sawing wood on the stage. Do you remember those types of scenes?
Yeah,
and then
there'd be a
character that would be wandering around,
creature
from the deep.
They were still trying to keep in touch with the avant-garde. But I think there was a real conflict with their wanting to be in a commercial world, you see. And obviously the commercial aspect, ultimately, the money side of it, probably, if we're going to be that candid, was what really won out, wasn't it? There are other performers that didn't care a sod, and nobody's ever heard of them.
Yeah.
They may be creatively very interesting people indeed, artistically, you know. But that's often the choices that are made. And I'll say, I think they were practical people, architects.
They kind of like
architects in action.
Battened down. Some discipline to it by that stage as well. And it was a theatrical show, beginnings of a theatrical show, which I suppose they'd done a little bit at Games for May in 67, hadn't they?
Yeah.
And there are definitely strong connections once again.
And they wanted to, but I think they wanted to be taken seriously. And I suppose my father liked the Pink Floyd in a way. And I think it was because I was interested. He'd seen them interviewing, and they said good middle-class boys, you know, that seem quite measured and sensible, not like these wild characters that we don't like, really. You know, that really a bit common and be a bit loutish in their behaviour, you know. So,
so this is you obviously recording at a concert, and you said it's a small reel-to-reel recorder, Philips.
Yeah. Did you manage to walk in?
How did you get it in? That's what I was going to ask.
I suppose we must have had a big overcoat or something.
Remind
me of the month.
It's June 69.
June.
Yeah. I was going to say, you can't have the Afghan coat and give birth to a reel-to-reel recorder.
I suppose
in June.
I can remember that sort of feeling of, do you think we'll get away with this? And waiting, they had someone at the gateway. You wait for a group of people where there's a load of people all going in. And we got quite adept of getting to the front or getting on stage. I've been a bit dodgy, has its, you know, advantages, doesn't it? We thought we'd get in that way. If we're getting a clump of people as we go, and once we're in, and we thought while we were doing it, somebody might be looking around.
Did you get any sense that anybody else was going to be trying to do the same thing as you?
Did you feel unusual, if you think about it, who's going to take what is quite a big thing?
You have to be a bit mad to take the risk. Audacious.
Yeah.
And you were getting audacious. I mean, you'd been on the stage at Hyde Park, hadn't you? You knew what you wanted to do.
If you've got the nerve, there's amazing things come out of it sometimes.
Act like you belong.
Why not? What's the worst? You know, it's that English thing about being embarrassed if you're caught. If you're not embarrassed if you're caught, or really willing to take the embarrassment, then you might achieve something rather good.
Well, there's no particular security at that stage in 69. I know the security stepped up in 74. I remember, for example, somebody telling me that they lived in Birmingham and there was no way after the Birmingham IRA bombings that they were ever going to be able to get a tape player into a concert. around that time. But in 69, I think things were probably quite relaxed.
Were your
bags checked or anything like that, like they would do now?
It was the whole idea. There wasn't the sort of the level. I mean, I don't know if they had had trouble to dance force with people having fights in the old days and whether they'd checked people for weapons or anything. But I don't remember it ever being that dangerous.
No.
You know, in that sort of, now it seems to be doing everything's dangerous, isn't it?
Mm.
The whole climate was different. And the other thing that was interesting about it was the hippie thing, of course, you know, everything expressed itself, everybody were all together. It was always sort of, not deference, but, you know, the sort of inclination to sort of, oh, yes, we're, you know, it's all free and, you know, we're all together and all that. So, even it must have been even at the concert halls, people thought, well, they're all basically good people.
Yeah, they're not going to cause any harm.
And for the Pink Floyd, they would have been regarded, oh, they're not like those loutish groups. They're going to cause trouble.
Yeah.
So they probably was a supposition that everybody would be, most people would be relatively well behaved.
Yeah.
They might take drugs. That might be a problem. But then nobody, I don't remember there ever being any sort of ray searching people for drugs or whatever in those.
No.
In those days, in those sort of places.
Yeah.
I think some of the festivals, it began, again, eventually, the drug squad and that used to, didn't they, sweep down and things.
Where were you sat at the Dome in June 69?
What was?
Whereabouts was your seat at the Dome?
I think we were upstairs, I'm sure.
Okay, on the balcony.
In my mind, I remember being looking down.
And do you have to hold your microphone out like this, you know,
well,
with an outstretched arm?
Well, because it's slightly tiered, isn't it? Up. That's the difference with the stalls. As it was slightly tiered, you didn't have to be too obvious.
Yeah.
You know,
so you just support your arm.
Because it would be slightly lower,
the
rope in front of you. So you could be like this.
Mm.
And I think we sort of, you know, just extended, if we had a coat.
Yeah, make sure that your neighbours are not looking at what you're up to.
My friend used to have, I don't know if he had it by then, but he certainly did have I've seen a photograph, Bobby.
Mm.
He had an Afghan coat or something. You see?
Yeah, he could have overheated in June.
And he wouldn't have been the only one in those days, you know. Apparently, when they get wet, they really smell. You know, cause,
yeah, like old dogs, perhaps.
Well, it's the goats, and it's goat skin or something.
Yeah.
But yeah, so... Yeah, I'd see it all in my mind's eye, and I remember sort of extending out a bit, and then, of course, changing reels and things.
It's pretty tricky in the dark, yeah.
Well, it was partly the dark, and also you're creating a bit of activity. Who's going to be doing that?
Threading a reel in the dark?
Yeah, that was
partly. Would you have used a lighter or something like that to show you?
Well, there were little sort of lights at the back of the, what's the name? I think in
the auditorium.
I think you could just about... see what you were doing from reflected light, possibly. But also, you didn't want to be doing it too.
No.
You wanted to get it over.
You don't want an usher to come out and say,
you
what are you doing? You
want to keep a low profile and hopefully nobody will notice.
Mm.
But most of the people in those places, if you aren't causing active trouble, they're waiting for it to be over so they can go home, aren't they? The actual staff.
Yeah.
Are not on bonus for catching people. And I don't think it was a problem then either. It wasn't like the band started complaining, they're stealing, people are bootlegging their stuff.
No, they started worrying about that the following year, didn't they?
Probably, yeah.
Yes.
But in 1970...
They started worrying about it then.
It became a benchmark. Because I remember, which we'll get round to, the one with the Big Apple, that venue, the Rolling Stones played at. And they were the first really big group to still be touring, and my friend Bobby went to, I wasn't there, I was away at college, I think. He went to that gig and he said he couldn't get into the press enclosure he had before because he did manage to talk his way in, but it was a bit touch and go because you're supposed to have passes and things, and now it's even worse because I did a bit of rock photography about 20 years ago, 15 years ago, you have to have accreditation all the time.
Right.
And they only let you take photographs for the first two numbers or something. I did some of the White Stripes at the Astoria before it was demolished.
Yeah.
Because I went back to try and do, and I did a bit. But the trouble, it was difficult to sell because the agencies had all taken over as well. So, you know, all the big publications, they had certain people already lined up. So you couldn't go even as a freelancer and then get your take around, because they don't need your photos, because they want them, they got them.
Yes.
So there was all these things that changed. Where there was, it was still, in general, it was much more freeform. And I think that's worth emphasising in every way, the context of the times.
Yeah, it's absolutely different, isn't it? Even, you know, between 67 and 69, I suppose, as well.
Things were moving quickly and everything. Yeah. We were just saying about the sound quality was getting better.
Improving. The stage, the audiences craft were getting bigger. Yeah.
And lots of things were.
Sounds like the light shows were getting worse. They were better in 67 than in 69.
Well, yeah, I think
they... Different.
Well, yeah, well, I think people didn't want to always... they liked the idea, but they... But then also don't forget there's all these sort of mini fashions within, and in, you know, you have something and then 2 years later people think of that, oh, that's old fashioned.
Old hat.
Let's do something different. Mm. And sometimes things come back again when they realise, oh, well, the novelty, it doesn't always have to be different. That, well, let's go back to that again. And I think it also there was like this, there was always this level of sort of looking back to some older style every now and then, you know, like rock and roll. I always remember rock and roll got sort of picked up in 1968, you know, or 50s rock and roll became fashionable again for a while.
Yeah.
And then it sort of drifted off.
A cycle, like you say. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So there's all these little strains that are affecting why people do things and what goes well. And I say, retrospectively, one sometimes forgets what you might have noticed at the time, you know.
So, a month after the Dome, man is landing on the moon.
Oh,
and
yeah,
you're
yeah.
tuning in to Omnibus. So what if it's only
Moonhead, you know,
green cheese with Judy Dench and others? Yeah,
yeah, yeah. So, and Patrick Moore.
Yeah. So, and you recorded that, of course.
Yeah, no, that.
You did that at home?
Oh, yes. Well, my friend, funny enough, my French friend was over as well. But that day, for some reason, anyway, I was still at school. I was school forever. Sixth form. You know, I was in the arty set. The others were like budding poets and, you know. And I was the artist in that school because I really had A-level art by then.
Mm.
And I went on to do English and history and things with them. Anyway, it was this group of us. We all listened to the most progressive stuff or whatever it was, you know.
Mm.
I heard one of my friends that unfortunately died this year, but I remember hearing that Paul, he was in this sort of set, he lived right next to the school, so we used to go and listen to the latest album in his living room.
Nice.
And I heard the Beatles' White Album and then his living room, remember? We nipped over in the lunch hour. It'd just come out.
Mm.
Apollo 11, they'd already gone to the moon. Mm. They're up in the sky and we were watching the newspapers and the TV bulletins and things. And anyway, we had a party, we had an informal party in the afternoon, and we were all smoking dope and listening to the right records, probably a bit of the Pink Floyd or something, amongst other things, up at his house. And then, so we came, I left there. I was living outside of Brighton, they were in Brighton. And I got the bus from where they lived. And I always remember this. So there was about three people on the bus, and the actual bus conductor, they had bus conductors then, was listening to it on a transistor radio, as they say, you know, the actual, and they were getting close to me, they were about to land on the moon, literally.
Yeah, the commentary. Mm.
And they got to this part, Preston Circus in the centre of Brighton. I remember stopping at the traffic lights, and he was listening to it. He said, "They've landed!"
Wow.
And everybody, all three or five of us on the bus, all cheered and clapped. I remember. Anyway, so I got back at the other end, because I'd been smoking a bit of dope. Everything was a little bit, you know, swing around a little bit. And my French friend was there.
Mm.
And I had the tape recorder. And I knew that it was going to be whenever it happened. And it was scheduled to happen that evening.
You'd looked at Radio Times or something, had you? Yeah.
Obviously, it had been postponed. And they were going to do it then after they'd done it, you see. So they probably had a floating set, didn't they?
Mm.
You know, it was expected to be then, but it will be... And so I had the tape recorder ready, and so that's when I recorded Moonhead off the thing.
So let me ask you a question about this. It might sound like a funny question, but did you see Pink Floyd on the screen as Moonhead played.
Of course, yeah.
Because somebody else I spoke to said that he couldn't recall seeing them on the screen. Remembers the music. They were in the studio.
It was like the being live. I don't know if it actually was live, but it was done like it was live. You know,
can you remember anything about the set in the studio? Was it like
They were just sitting around.
Oh, that was the presenters were just sitting around. No, I thought Floyd was sitting around.
But it was a bit more relaxed, you know. They were sort of all hustled. Maybe they were standing. But I don't vaguely remember. I've got my image of
it.
Might have been sitting. It was certainly looking in a more relaxed state. It wasn't like a very rigid sort of...
It's got a casual feel to it.
It was very casual, that's the way it came across. And I'd love that. I like that riff, which, of course, got repurposed, didn't it?
Like everything, yeah.
But I think it really originated in... Interstellar Overdrive. They recycled a lot of their riffs, didn't they? Yeah. A lot.
Particularly Roger.
Because he couldn't do much more.
There we say. Yes.
Yeah, it was great. And I used to play that a few times afterwards because I rather liked it. Yeah, but they obviously just did it for that, didn't they?
Shame no film survives because the BBC binned
everything. That seems incredible, doesn't it? Really?
Yeah. It's thanks to you that these things... still are around. A few people captured it, but you got a good capture of it.
Because I had my Tally Funkel, which was really, as you know, by then.
Did you hold a microphone to the speaker of the telly? Is that how
I probably
you did? It?
Yeah, that's how I did it. I got that for Christmas of 67 probably. I think it was. I got it.
Home recorder, basically. Yeah, and that's Philips was the concerts.
I did everything off the radio with that, and dragged it to somebody. I remember recording one of the Pink Floyd Top Gear sessions at a friend's house. He was a musician. Mm. He was a guitarist that played in a group I used to do light shows for. And I took the whole thing. We've been recording at his house. I said, I'll come and see you, but I've got to record this off the radio.
Got a job to do. And when you recorded off the radio, did you do that by holding a microphone to a speaker as well? Or was there a way of plugging it in?
It was a little stand of the one that I've lost the original. I've still got the body of the recorder still, but the actual microphone, it was a little stand, a little square microphone.
That plugs into the real stand.
You could put it up like that.
Up by the speaker, and that's how you captured your recordings.
And that was usually good enough. You didn't have an output into those old... TVs anyway.
You needed to be quiet, and you needed nobody to come in the room while you were making your
best
recording.
To do it by yourself. You know?
Yeah, yeah, makes sense. So next up, it's the 8th of August, 1969, and you're at Plumpton.
Oh yeah, yeah, because that was the Jazz and Blues Festival, wasn't it?
It was indeed,
And it was moved. It was usually out. Funny where I used to do antique fairs for a long time. At Kempton Park Racecourse, and they'd done most of them there. For some reason, I think they're refurbishing it or something, and they had to move it for at least, I think it was it just that year? Possibly was, which was suited us because it was close to where we all live.
Perfect, yes.
And I've got a few photographs. In fact, I saw one on just a small sort of negative I looked through last night, and it was the two of us on the train, the lead singer of a band I used to do, he was going to it, and another friend from another situation on the train on the way there.
And let's see that photograph again that we were looking at earlier, because you said that you got a photograph from the edge of the stage. Who took the picture? This is of Roger Waters.
I took that one, yeah.
You took it on the edge of the stage. And in the bottom right-hand corner of the shot is... another photographer with a medium format camera. And as I said earlier, I could have sworn that you got another shot somewhere with somebody looking like they've got an 8mm camera. Yeah, from that concert. And it's a portrait shot. I don't know if I've imagined it, but I don't think
we had a go at filming that. It wouldn't have worked, you see.
No.
The only time I ever worked with the cine camera... in a nighttime set, even in a festival, was that we went to Fun City about in 70 and to see the MC5.
MC5, yeah.
And luckily, Ronan O'Reilly had this idea of pirate TV, and so he had all these TV cameras with all TV lighting, so it was bright enough for our film. Mm. Otherwise, it wouldn't exist, you see, because it wouldn't have been strong enough lighting.
Well, it's a lovely picture. Is there a slide that went with that, a negative that went with that you still got, or is,
because this, oh, feels like other, a, this feels like negatives. A modern, so that, I had that printed modern about print 25 years ago, probably 20 years ago or something, when I started doing things again, you know, doing a lot more photography. I printed some of the older stuff, and of course I had did a lot of stuff for the MC5, which is another story. And I've got a bit of film, that film I was mentioning. I've got another piece of film which we'll get round to.
Yes.
Or I can show you.
And that 1970 bit of film.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I'd like to see
that. That was again the same camera, but that was in daylight, so you were okay. You know?
Yeah. So you recorded the audio as well.
Yeah.
At Plumpton.
I actually put the tape recorder on the stage.
Did you? The Philips with the microphone.
Yeah.
Oh, I never knew that. How fascinating.
That's why the bass is so strong, you know.
Yes.
It's fantastic bass. There's another recording I've heard, it's so much more distant.
Yes.
It's so strong because it was right next to the Nathan.
Three people taped it and you were the third taper.
Oh, yeah.
Fascinating.
Literally put it on the stage. Can you believe it?
Yeah.
And we did the same at the MC5 one. It was literally on the stage going round.
And it took it. Wow. Well, I can see where you're close up for this photograph. So did you just leave it on the stage and then start taking pictures?
Well, it wasn't directly in front of Roger Waters.
No,
it was nearer the speaker at the side by then.
I was moving around a bit. Yeah.
yeah.
Well, congratulations for capturing it without distortion as well.
I love that. It's one of my favourite versions of Interstellar Overdrive.
Yeah,
that
I agree. It's a very fine performance, and it was, you know, it was
well driven.
A great ending to the concert, that was.
And also that it was really sort of like being in a soundtrack to significant events, because the moon, it was a full moon in the sky, it was a clear night, and it was sinking. They're playing Interstellar Overdrive. It's like an anthem, really, isn't it?
Yes.
And up in there is the astronauts were back by then, but the flag was up there, and the Eagle lander was still on the moon, which I've incidentally seen again, haven't they? The Indian space program saw it. It's still
good,
there.
Though. Oh, good. Good.
Yeah, it's still there on the Sea of Tranquility.
Doubters who say that it was all a hoax. How do you explain that?
No, that's like that one off, isn't it?
Yeah, it does, doesn't it? That'll be the end of all of those YouTube channels. But yeah, a brilliant concert. Yeah. I think by that stage, obviously, they had really grasped it. They'd found their mojo.
Well, there was a lot of energy, I remember, particularly. Yeah. I got a great photograph as well, which I can't show you at the moment. I took directly in front of Nick Mason, right directly in front of these two sort of the high tom-toms, the ones with the raised tom-toms, you know. Mm. So it's right dead on, you know, and it's sort of directly below. So he's got his hat on. And
powerful.
And I had that on my bedroom wall. Uh-huh. I had it a big print
of it. You had it enlarged.
It'll turn up sometime. It must be around somewhere. But,
I'm feeling like there's a book coming on with your photographs here.
Well, there's a few that are good enough.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, when they looked at a lot when I contributed to In the Flesh.
Yes.
Well, they only chose to use that one in the end.
Yeah. Who did you work with on that? Did you work with Ian or with Glenn on that? Or did you work
with
both
of them? Well, they both came around to visit me.
Yeah.
And I think they maybe occasionally they both sort of communicated because they were collating stuff. And they asked me loads of questions like, you know, about how things fitted together at the time and what did I remember about this. And so a lot of the set lists, of course, and I've got a reasonably good memory.
You've got an excellent memory. I mean, it's as though you kept a diary, to be honest. Yeah. Your memories are so clear.
Yeah, because it made a big impact on me and I really liked it. And I probably am like a living video camera. I do tend, especially visual things.
Like a bit of a photographic memory? Would you describe
it exactly,
that way?
Well, not exactly, but there's some element of... I find that's why it was very good for the business I was in for most of my life, because back in the back of your mind, something, you know, you've seen that shape or an image, or you can't always pin it down.
Mm.
A friend of mine showed me a bronze the other day, and I thought, I'm sure I've seen... He can't find anything online. I said, I'm sure I've seen it somewhere. Mm. It may have been just a brief visit to a museum in Italy or something.
But it's stuck.
You know, it's weird, isn't it? You don't know what the... As long as your brain's still working, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, one, you know, as you get older, anything can happen to you. I do occasionally forget names, as you do, as you get.
Yes.
But most stuff, it's amazingly clear.
Perhaps my closest friend who I work with on the Pink Floyd stuff is Ian Russell, who Glenn as well. So we work collaboratively on quite a lot of stuff nowadays. And he remembers very fondly seeing you back then. And he's helped me a bit with some of the questions for today, because he remembers some of the things that you showed him, that you gathered. And it was interesting you made the point earlier, I think it was during the break between the recording, about how you gathered everything for that particular meeting. And there was some quite special stuff back then, photographs and so on. And then you kindly allowed them to use the Hyde Park picture for the book.
Yeah, I forgot the envelope. I found the envelope from Bloomsbury.
Yeah.
Then they sent it all back to me in.
So you got it back.
But
good.
I put other things in it. Well, some of the Pink Floyd stuff, but some other things as well. But as you say...
We could do a Ian and Ian meets Greg at some point and perhaps try and go through some stuff again.
What I'm going to now make a point, like I've done with my own Coon-related stuff, I'm going to put all the Pink Floyd, collate it again. Mm. For some reason, it seems to have got dispersed again.
Mm.
Sometimes you get a project, and if you don't put it back, you know, if you want to show somebody something or something, and then you put it back somewhere else, then it gets lost in the general. But there's probably still. I'm keen to actually.
Let's try.
Well,
and
I'm
do
still
that.
Compos mentis
yes.
too.
Let's make it a project for 2026 at some point. So we've done 8th of August 1969. Now we're into 1970, and you were off the mark on the 19th of January, back at the Dome again.
Yeah, I don't remember a lot of that.
No.
But that's probably partly because sometimes they played basically a lot of the same stuff. There wasn't something differentiated, especially, like, as you know, certain things have stayed in my memory.
Yes.
You can, because they were quite often at the Dome, it seems, over the time. Mm. Probably one of their favourite. It wasn't too far from London, was it?
And it's no.
reasonably sophisticated.
Nick Mason described it as a favourite venue, didn't he?
Yeah. But I think it probably was.
They played.
And also, didn't they premiere Dark Side of the Moon there years later? So
yeah, absolutely. It was. I suppose it was the acoustics. It was the friendly audience.
Yeah. So, and I think there's another thing worth saying about Brighton that is traditionally, in terms of conventional theatre, was always a tryout venue because they reckon, you know, it was closer to London, you know, so there was a new play. They sometimes used to try it down in Brighton.
Ah.
And maybe perhaps the Floyd felt like about certain ideas as well.
That's interesting.
They didn't want to include it because, as I say, it wasn't too far away. The audience wasn't too provincial and too behind the times not to be, you know, going to fit into what might go well for the next phase or whatever you were doing. And maybe that's one of the motives.
So forgive me for pushing you when you said you don't remember much about it, but two things occur to me. Firstly, the previous two concerts you've been to at the Dome and Plumpton, you've recorded.
Well,
but you didn't record this one.
Well, yeah. I think there's a couple of reasons for that, possibly. A, every time you went, you were running the gauntlet.
Mm-hmm. Time to give it a break.
And obviously the Azimuth was a major, wanted to get that because it's going to be a really interesting thing. And also with about being the whole moon thing as well, and being a festival. And also, of course, there was Soft Machine on the bill as well. I think we might have recorded a bit of them, I'm not sure.
I haven't heard that. Yeah.
I can't remember if we did or not.
Mm.
I did take one or two photos, I think, of Soft Machine.
They were
well.
Strong in 69, weren't they?
Yeah. And those are the two I remember, but obviously the Floyd and them, seeing their sets. And I think but there's other people that weren't on the night we went. I mainly went for the Floyd, because the Who played another night, but I didn't go, I only just went for the Floyd. Well, it was partly money as well, you know, probably.
Ian Senior remembers Bobby having a slide or perhaps some slides from the 19th of January 1970 Dome performance.
Right.
Is that possible that you had those?
Might have been. As I say, something seemed to. I'm pretty good on most stuff, but there's something. I feel it must. I'll tell you what I can remember. And it's obviously in your memory. You're wondering, is it? Am I projecting, or is it? Or was it there? I've got to remember. I can remember quite well. I don't know if it was after the Azimuth one or not. Probably not, because we would have been up in the circle. Would have been a long way to go. I remember going to the stage and seeing David Gilmour's stuff after they finished playing, and looking at the echo chamber, you know, the Binson Aircraft, just see what all their equipment was, you know, close up.
Yes.
And I think that was then, probably. That's my only memory I've got.
Interesting.
But it was more, and it's sort of logically, as I said, we definitely upstairs when we were doing the Azimuth. So that's when that's my only memory I can. I think they played things like Cell, Source and Felicity. I remember that.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was what they ended with. Careful, Embryo, main theme from Moore.
Yeah, and Embryo as well, I like. Mm. I like that as a track. Mm.
You will have seen an early Atom Heart Mother.
Yeah, possibly. Because it was very much, it maybe didn't make him much an impression at that point. But Embryo I liked, and I remember. And of course, they played Source for the Secrets a lot, didn't they? Mm.
Yeah.
Quite consistently. But I think it was also quite an easy one for them to do, wasn't it?
Yeah, they'd done it so many times by that point, I suppose.
And I can remember him, he did some very interesting, because we were playing as well, though I didn't mention this.
Yeah, you were looking for inspiration, I suppose.
We used to do odd bits of songs about, in 68, the first one of the Fringe Brighton Festival, I think it was 68. Would it have been 68? No, it would have been in 69. There was a guy of mine called Richard Bennett who could make electronic things, and he made a sort of a frequency generator where you could, you know, in fact, it's the sound you get at the beginning of Silver Machine by Hawkwind. Mm-hmm. I mean, we used it, and we got this date in a pub venue. It was like a theatre, a small theatre at the back of this pub near the Brighton station. And we did this pseudo like Pink Floyd number. Bobby played the drums because he's a drummer. Mm. And I played the bass guitar in a very rudimentary Roger Waters like way.
Yes.
And I called this guy Ricardo Bennett, you know, to give him an extra. His name was Richard Bennett. I thought I'd give him.
Yeah, that sounds fun.
Because we had this other thing at school. We were going to do this avant-garde music event, and it never came off. But he was going to do some of the electronics. And that we were going to get unusual things like a bit of the core of the drums from the military corps to play and throw all these things together. This was in 69. And also a bit of the school orchestra. It couldn't really play very well anyway. And, you know, that was the idea. I did this funny poster with all this, and I billed him as Ricardo Bennett. Anyway, so we did this, and we called this number Capello, and there was a recording of that somewhere as well.
Ah.
If you accidentally find it in a tape, you might think it's Pink Floyd. But it's just this generation of him doing effects with an echo chamber. So we were looking to see how they were getting the effects as well. Sound as well as light.
Yes, fellow musicians.
You dignify it with a similar thing, but... You know, it was this whole idea, what can we, you know, what new territories can you explore? Mm. You just had a go. So that was another element, obviously. So, it's all becoming clearer in my mind now.
So after the 19th of January, your next concert was the 27th of June, Bath Festival Blues and Progressive Music.
That was an exciting year because the festivals were beginning to gear up. And obviously I was into other bands apart from the Pink Floyd.
Mm.
I like the Mother's Invention and Captain Beefheart and The Nice. And I don't know if they were still playing by then, by 69. But, you know, there was a certain people I sort of followed. And suddenly anybody that was slightly different as well, I always found attractive. So that festival was great because it had nearly everybody. There was a few people we would have liked to see. But it, of course, famously had Led Zeppelin.
Yeah.
On the Sunday, it had amazing Jefferson Airplane, the Mothers of Invention, because I particularly like to see, nearly every band was worth seeing, you know.
Yeah.
But the trouble being one of these 1960s stroke in the 76. It was terribly disorganized in some ways. There was terrible delays, you know, nobody played on time.
Yeah, so even though they started,
When I saw Tommy got to the Pink Floyd, I was getting a bit, that's when they had the musicians with them.
They
didn't
did. They have the orchestra with them, didn't they? Choir and brass.
Yeah, the whole lot.
Grattan Hartmother.
Yeah, they could hardly get on the stage. You know, it was all trying to crowd in. Mm. And somebody I heard read something about coming down. You know, they came down on the train or something.
Did they?
But the trouble is, they didn't get to play. That must have caused terrible trouble.
Mm.
They didn't get to play until quite late. It was ridiculous.
No, it was the early hours of the Sunday morning.
It was like half past 12 or 1 o'clock
which
in the morning.
Which is not what you do to choir and brass, is
and
it?
And I was beginning to flag, because I'd been in the press enclosure for 12 hours by then.
Oh, wow.
Because I
got
in.
Photographs?
Yeah, I took, you know. Again, I had to ration myself because I didn't want. I only had a certain amount of film. I did take about two or three films, but some things I wish I'd had more than I.
Yeah, and did you have a genuine press pass to get you into that?
Oh yeah, well I made a press pass to get into that. It was like one of those war films where they fake the documents, you know, in
a
prisoner of war film where they tried to escape, you know.
Yeah.
And I faked a press card. I got letter set, and I spent ages. I did it quite well. I got a photograph and I got my father to sign it. I did it in a false name as well.
Wow.
Partly because this guy
Not
was a graphic.
Echo.
No, it was this guy, it was a graphic designer in Brighton I'd met. He gave me two of his cards and they were a bit avant-garde. They were printed on celluloid, so they were see-through.
Oh.
And there were two. Paul Brand, his name was, I remember. So I called myself Paul Brand. I've still got the card, the fake card. And I thought, if I'm Quentin Tarantino, if they show them that sort of card, they'd be so impressed by it's so out there, man, and so sort of modern and infinite. They think, he must be, we won't think.
He must be good.
Any other identification. You go, is that that? You know,
yeah.
So that's why part, and also to save me if I, you know, my real identity. But anyway, so we got it. We didn't need it, of course. That effort took me about a week or so. That effort, because they had Hell's Angels who couldn't read anyway. So
as
the security guards, they were still persisting with that there, you know.
Mm.
And so we got in, but I thought, I don't want to go out of the press enclosure and then I meet somebody different the next time I have an issue. So once I'm in, I'll stay in.
That's pretty uncomfortable for 12 hours.
Yeah, I think there must have been a toilet somewhere there.
Yeah.
You know, backstage, you see, because you can go backstage.
Yeah.
So what happened to me, I can't remember which day of it was the day after the Floyd or not, but I'll tell you, it's a good sexy story.
Mm.
I was talking to somebody last night about this, about the epidioscopes, because they had the Jefferson Airplane brought their light show with them.
Mm.
And the guy was upstairs, by, you know, they were doing it on a back projected thing.
Mm.
And I thought, I'll go up and have a look and see how they do it. So I went up when the Jefferson Airplane were playing. And I was literally on stage. I could see that. And I was standing behind Grace Slick. I was my 60s, 70s, stroke 70s memory. But, you know, she was wearing this fringe white sort of coat thing. You know, she's singing Need Somebody to Love or, you know. I mean, that was extraordinary. But I think that might have been the next day. But the Floyd, as you say, were very much late thing. And they had the gong and everything.
Yeah.
And of course, I'd already seen Atom Heart Mother as well.
Yes.
I hadn't seen
you,
it.
Well, you'd seen a form of it on the 19th of January, but it hadn't made much of an impression.
Yeah, as you put it. But it was a bit, because I was getting very tired by then.
Mm.
As I said, that 13 hours standing up or laying down. I did try and take a photograph, and I've got a couple of rather blurred photographs because you had to put it on such a long long sequence, you know, it was long speed, you know, it was slightly blurred, you know, even if it was like, to get any light on it at all. So I thought I'd take a two just for the sake of it, but those were the only ones.
But you didn't try and capture the audio at that one, obviously.
No, well, again, we would have had double the trouble, wouldn't
we? Yeah, it would have been. It would have been, what's that to do with you?
If you were a photographer, you were allowed to be a photographer, weren't you?
Yes, absolutely.
If you were in the press enclosure.
That's authentic, isn't it?
Yeah. And they were getting a bit more, probably, noted, you know, other bands, not just as well, maybe, maybe not just the Floyd, but you know, other bands would be a bit in touch.
Were you there on your own for that one, or was Bobby fellow photographer?
Yeah. Well, I think he didn't take so many photographs. I can't remember if he had a camera with him at that time. He had a London taxi, and we drove all the way there in this old London taxi that he bought second hand. And there's some bits of film of us on the way on 9mm film and by said Stonehenge. It was a great, it was fantastic. And everybody talks about it. It was a great. But I must tell you, I got one interesting link with that, which again came back, was that they did, at the culmination of Atom Half Mountain, they had these rockets let off.
Big flares. Three big flares.
Well, they were the proper rockets. And I saw them, sort of a bloke doing it at the distance, so I went round and quickly looked while they were doing it. And, you know, because I was just moving around. And they went... And they were really bloody great big rockets.
Yeah.
And it was quite a spectacular effect. And the guy, about a year later, when I was working with Bruce Lacey and I'd stay at his place, one of the other artists living there was Jules Baker. Mm. And he did the special effects of Pink Floyd in the theatre.
Ah.
And he did the rockets, and he told me, as he said, he'd never done it in his life before. And he was really genuinely worried.
Yeah, that big audience.
He'd either set fire to the place or cause some terrible disaster. But it just shows you how laissez-faire everything was.
Yeah.
And I was fascinated. I'll tell you a bit late subsequently, but he did some other effects on the Floyd. But I got to be quite good friends with him, so quite interesting storylines there, yeah.
Gosh. So your next concert was 18th of July. What was that? 21 days, 3 weeks later, you were at Hyde Park for the second Hyde Park concert.
I think that's probably why I didn't pay. I knew it was coming up.
Yeah.
And I did listen and I was good. Yeah, but that was a much better place to listen to it properly, you know, because we were in the press enclosure there as well.
Yes.
And we got in there and got there very early and got in.
And you recorded the audio there.
Yeah.
And you took photos.
So Bobby must have done that. Oh. And I think I remember the tape. Again, we put it on the side of the stage.
So was that, was the Philips still?
The Philips recorder with
the microphone. And that was put on the stage.
I don't think I got the cassette until, as far as I remember, just a little bit later that year.
Mm. Wow.
Maybe.
So you got that on the stage and you're taking photographs. Were you filming as well?
Yeah. With the old wind up cine camera.
Right.
And there were two films and one got ruined.
Okay.
And that was mostly the Pink Floyd's concert at the time, on the day.
Most of the concert you got?
I had it transferred.
Right.
It still exists, but it's just you just vaguely see, and there's loads of white because obviously it's all bleached.
Right.
By the light getting into the camera.
Oh, right. Yeah.
And you just see, you know, it's Nick Mason's drums and that's it.
Yeah.
I've got about 2 minutes of very good film.
Yeah.
That I did that again really close up. It wasn't from a long distance. We were like in front of the stage.
Yeah. It's silent. I take it this film.
Yeah. No sound.
Yeah.
But you probably could all, well, it's bits, isn't it? Because
yeah.
you only have 3 minutes of film with those old 8mm cameras. So ours was standard 8, not super 8 as well.
Okay.
And it had a clockwork mechanism, so you had to keep winding it. If you didn't, it got faster and faster when you played it back, because the film was going through slower.
Yes.
But we just did odd little shots, you know, because having so little film.
But from a very close vantage point.
Yeah, but it was so right in front of the stage, literally. And it's the only colour footage I've heard of.
Oh, there is a little bit more colour footage. Somebody was further back was taking
Far away, but not
film.
That. Yes. Not close.
And then obviously Hoppy's team was filming from the rafters as well, but that's black and white.
Yeah, I've seen those videos. Yeah.
They've given an official release to the Atom Heart Mother, and there's a bit of embryo and set of controls, which didn't come out. They did a restoration of that for their box set.
It was a little bit... When I was at art school, I remember... Because I went to art school in the autumn. Was it? Yeah, it would have been, yeah. And he said, oh, we were there. He said, some guys, him and his girlfriend, they had a flat, which is basically a penthouse of this building over. Well, they weren't there, but they heard it from there, looking over in Marble Arch. It was this, they got given a free flat and in terms of being like janitors.
Yeah.
And they said, oh, we could see everything from miles away, but, you know, and the music was wafting up. I always remember that aspect to it as well.
So you caught about an hour of audio that day.
Oh, yeah, that's good. Well, that was... Well, we were hoping to do a bit more. As I say, we were going to have at least 8 minutes of... Well, 7 minutes probably of film. We might... You know, because we'd invested money in those films. Because, I mean, in today's money, it would have been about 30 quid a shot for just 3 minutes.
Yeah.
You know, once you had it developed. So, you know, that's £60 of investment, you know, isn't it?
So you've digitised the film, you said, this 2 or 3 minutes of film of yours.
And we've got that. Yeah. I've got a copy of that here.
And we could perhaps watch that a bit later, have a look at
that. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So it won't take you too long, 2 minutes.
You haven't put it on YouTube or anything like that?
No, it's never been seen.
Ah.
And my friend who says that if you could license it with Getty, and if anybody wants to make a documentary...
It would be ideal for that, wouldn't it? Mm. There's various footage from that concert, so somebody ought to knit it all together. I think that would be quite a nice project at some point. Maybe Sony would want to do something like that.
Well, it would be nice to... have another copy of it somewhere. The guy, in case you're interested, this guy that I met, he's very good. I met him through the MC5 thing.
Oh, yeah.
Incidentally, it came because he was a big MC5 fan. And I said, oh, I'd done, you know, did I have any more, he said. And he's a professional. He does what he does. He transfers. He does stuff for the BBC and everything.
Oh, nice.
He's got this most amazing question. He can do any format as well.
Yeah.
He could do... not just all the different films, like 8mm standard 8, 16mm, 35mm. Mm. He can do videotapes of all types, commercial videotape, VHS, Betamax, even mini discs and things he can do.
Nice. Yeah.
He can do obsolete. He's amazing. Yeah. Range, he's got things he can do.
Yeah.
He can do cassette tapes, normal tape, you know, virtually the whole range.
Yeah.
And now it's got a high definition transfer thing as
Excellent.
Well. So
what if you got it as a file, or is it on a DVD or something like that?
He can do it on a DVD if you want it.
Yeah.
But he's been sending us stuff on files, and
we
got a VHS one of my son was on Meridian TV when he was 9. You know, went to stage school.
Yeah.
And they did a little segment about stage school, and anyway, he was interviewed on the telly, and I'm in that as well.
Mm.
And my wife was in it. He just transferred that recently. So that,
excellent.
And it's turned out quite well, apparently. And the stuff he'd done before, now he's got this other equipment, it's even better.
Yes,
it really looks like it's now. It's improved to such a level.
Technology is jumping forward. It's good because we need it. We need these things to be preserved before they start giving up.
Oh, yeah, well, he's very good at it, and he's saved quite a few stuff, tapes of this, because you have to bait them when they, because he said they often, you know, so you have to do it, because he said, well, my films were on the last legs. He said they were turning vinegar. So it's getting, it's a bit worrying. We're on the last chance saloon, aren't we?
We are a bit, aren't we? So your next concert was at the Big Apple, Regent Theatre Brighton, 22nd. Oh, not 22nd. I was thinking of Sheffield for a moment there. The 11th of December, 1970.
Well, yeah, so that was very significant.
It was, because you met the band.
Yeah, yeah.
Tell me about that.
So that was, that was an extraordinary... so basically, the Big Apple was a ballroom on the fourth floor of this big... what was the Regent Cinema, but it was like a 1920s, 30s entertainment complex, and they built this quite big ballroom on the fourth floor.
Mm.
And it hadn't been used for years, and for some reason somebody did the Rolling Stones played there, and then I saw the Floyd played. So I did tape a bit of it, as you know, but unfortunately, I had other things happen, and so... Because my friend of mine was doing the light show, not for the Pink Floyd, but for the venue. He had the thing, somebody I know that did light shows at Bright Humour. And so that was part of the advantage, because So I must have got some sort of pass or something or whatever. But yeah. Anyway, so when it was the interval, there must have been a support band, I suppose. I said, actually, where are the dressing rooms? I thought, I'll get them, you know.
Yeah.
And he said, oh, well, they're down there, you know, they're good, right. So I thought, have I got the comfort, you know, courage to go and, you know.
Could have gone horribly wrong.
Yeah, we could have been. Well, it's also, you know, yeah. English embarrassment, having the nerve does pay off.
Yes.
I did feel a bit full of trepidation. So I went, I found out to where the, and there was nobody about, you know. I went down the corridor and I was thinking, oh, God, that's their dressing room. They must be in there. If I knock on the door, you know.
Yeah.
Anyway, this guy came up to me and said, oh, can I help you? And I looked up and it was Rick Wright.
Brilliant.
And he said, and I said, I wouldn't mind meeting the band if that's possible. He said, oh, come in.
Oh, fabulous.
So yeah. I went into this room, which wasn't that big, with just the Pink Floyd. Nobody with them, no managers or anybody else. It was just me and the Pink Floyd.
Yeah.
And there was obviously Roger Waters and David Gilmour and Nick Mason and Rick Wright. And then I talked to him for about 20 minutes.
What did you talk about?
Well, I was, because I had loads of things I wanted to know. I was almost like an interview really.
Yeah. You needed to have your recorder with you at that moment,
I had some ideas of my own. How have you thought about
it? Did you really?
I was hoping to be given a job.
Did you really? You went for it. You just...
Oh, yeah.
No shyness. Well,
I don't, because I was a serious
fan. That was your
chance. As I say, I think serious...
But you were a musician.
Well, I don't know if I was.
Well,
but,
you were creative.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I would have liked to have been involved with hypnosis or something to do with that. You know, I saw them going down a pathway I would like to go. And, you know, I know maybe a bit sort of overambitious, but I thought... I definitely, because I've been doing light shows by then, and we thought up some of our own. We'd done some, so I had a lot of ideas about things. And so I started talking to what I do remember about the conversation, that I don't remember Roger Waters speaking, which seems odd, because he's always the spokesman in the group. He's usually the one that always does the interviews, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, back in those days, anyway.
Yeah.
When for the Floyd. And David Gilmour was responded to quite a lot of my questions, and Rick said the odd thing, but he he's quite shy, isn't he? Really, in real life, he's
more
reticent in some ways. And I remember Nick Mason being quite cynical, you know,
quite dry.
David Gilmour was quite a decent guy in that sense, I would have thought,
but.
I have a theory about them, what was going on, which I only come to relatively recently because I read some of the things that are happening. They were talking about on some site or whatever. They were saying that, or somebody who seemed to know, said there was a lot of tension going on in the group.
Often,
as we know.
Frequently,
And I have this theory that Rick Wright invited me in because I was an outsider, and Roger was in the corner sulking.
Yes.
And the other sort of welcomed the excuse to talk to somebody outside the immediate circle.
That makes sense. Diffuse the tension between the band. And have to have a big confab about what's just gone wrong with the first half of the concert. Or what they're going to do next.
You should apply yourself more. Because Waters was... as we know, famous for being very sort of over-demanding and sort of a bit of a bully-like figure in some ways, wasn't he?
Yeah.
So I felt that's probably how I might have got... Because they could have evenly said no. Often that was always the risk when you...
Yeah.
You...
So Richard Wright jumps to the door and thinks, look, this is my chance to bring in somebody who's going to diffuse this atmosphere.
Yeah. I mean, I liked him. He was very... sympathetic. He was but I was going to say my impression also of meeting them at the time. I thought that you had this idea. You think artists, you know, they're going to be artistic types, and you know, very sort of quite sort of not soft, but you know, sort of expressive,
sophisticated.
And, you know, like,
yeah.
And what I've always say this to people, it was like meeting some people from the army.
Right.
They were quite masculine, sort of. They weren't one sort of artistic figures you'd think.
Yeah.
They were like soldiers, like
what, practical.
Yeah, practical sort of. You know, when you have to be in the front line, you get on with it. And
yeah.
They had that sort of robust quality, it seemed to me. Mm. And I think that's very clear in their whole career. They toured for generations almost, didn't they? Mm. For decades and decades. And that's pretty demanding from what I've understood. People I've spoken to have toured and that.
Mm.
They were tough characters, and obviously a lot. Sid got ruined in the first year. I don't know if it was just that, but it was obviously a strong factor.
They had to be resilient, didn't they?
Yeah, they were tough, and you know, they could take it. You know, and they demanding. You know, and they would take it. Sid wouldn't, obviously, even if he probably would have left if even he'd stayed. Probably, you know, if he hadn't had to leave, he probably would have. Or he would have done something so outlandish that he thought, well, this is not going to sell, you know. Mm. Probably it's not going to be a bit too out. Because he wasn't, I don't think he was, fame didn't really bother him, did it? Or money. I don't think it really seemed to be a concern of his. Mm. And also, he didn't like, again, which is quite an interesting approach, he genuinely didn't like to be commodified. He went along with the pop thing until it got too serious. Mm. And like you said, you can only do this, you can only go there, you can only do this, you know. And, you know, he did with his art, didn't he? Mm. He had this thing about destroying all his paintings.
Yeah.
And that's because he did that, because he wasn't an object to be taken beyond him. He'd seen, had that happen as a in music, and he probably thought...
He had that expression and he didn't need to hold on to it.
No, if you don't, you know, he liked the process of being... Yeah. The artistic process was
very much living in the moment, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
So you recorded a couple of songs, just coming back to that, Saucerful and Eugene.
Yeah.
I think.
Well, you know, it was Saucerful, I think, yeah.
Yeah.
That's what I reckon from the days when I used to listen to it. It's got
did
a
you put your,
since.
Put your recorder on the stage again? Or
no, there was a cassette recorder, of course.
Cassette by that stage. Because
yeah,
I know
yeah.
the
well,
next
got,
concert we're talking about is think, definitely a cassette.
Yeah, that was a... And I don't... A, they were very long.
Yeah.
So they took up quite a lot of space. But I must have been... Either couldn't record it or... I was distracted in some way. I took photos, of course.
Yes,
so
I couldn't come to those.
I couldn't, you know,
couldn't do both.
Right, in the, fairly close.
What's
know.
Happened to the photos? Are they
well,
missing?
They're around
at
somewhere.
Yeah.
They're not very low light problems, you see. Because, but I had a go, and it's quite a good one. It's a bit grainy. It might be able to be improved now with all the new technology of Rogers grimacing, smashing the cymbals.
Oh.
But it wasn't brilliant quality. I mean, I thought they would have been interested in that for the book, but. It was obviously not good enough quality for their at that time, but now you might be able to.
Yeah, no, Ian Senior is certainly interested in seeing those again. As,
yeah, they're around somewhere or negatives. Yeah. I'm sure. Yeah.
Yes. Quite the concert, quite the end to the year. We've got two more to go.
Yeah, we're nearly there on the home stretch.
We're nearly there, folks. I mean, it's been such a fascinating session. I think everybody's going to be blown away by your stories, to say the least. Saturday the 15th of May 1971, 2 days before I was born. You were at the garden party in Crystal Palace.
Yeah, that was when I was, that was in 1971. Yeah, so I was at art school. I was at St Martin's then.
Yeah.
You know, in Charing Cross Road.
And you made a recording there.
Yeah, that was from the old cassette, which I hadn't had, as I said, by then, only for probably 9 months or so, or a year, if that.
I've got a theory about your recording.
And it was raining that day, I remember.
That's exactly my theory. It was raining.
Oh.
And then I think when it stopped raining, you decided to walk down the hill and you put your recorder on.
Yeah.
And you caught Return of the Son of Nothing, which was to become Echoes.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So, well, it was great. I like that. And I used to play that cassette. I remember, you know, that I'd recorded before it came out, obviously, you know.
Mm.
And I'll tell you another distinctive memory I have there was there was the smell of wild garlic in the air.
I was about to ask you about that as well, because that's always stuck in my mind, and I've quoted that many years. Greg smelt wild garlic at
The gardens to the Crystal Palace. It was where it's like the bowl, isn't it? There's a pond in front of the stage.
Yes,
and quite a big pond
with a dodgy octopus in it.
It's a sort of half shell, isn't it? A half sphere. It's like the acoustics are supposed to be good, but it's in this ornamental gardens, and there would have been all sorts of exotic plants, because that was part of the Crystal Palace idea, wasn't it?
Yes.
Originally, you know, back in 19th century.
Yeah,
and I obviously wild garlic, and of course the water. In fact, it had been raining earlier, and then it left off, and then obviously it started warm up slightly. Sometimes that has an effect on, doesn't it, on plants?
Yes.
And it makes them breathe out or whatever. It was very sort of Victorian-y sort of smell to me in my fanciful sort of imagination.
Yeah.
But it was a very distinctive atmosphere, literally.
Yes. And there you are clonking down the hill, because you can hear your going clonk, clonk,
yeah,
clonk,
yeah, because I could get to a better position.
As you're walking down to get towards...
Yeah, because we were under the... When it was really heavy rain, we were under the
tree.
Yeah, we're under the trees at the edge. We all went to the edge because that's where the branches were big enough to shield you from the rain. And then when it stopped, then we moved. And there were like these sort of, as far as I remember, sort of bushes like laburnum or whatever. Mm. And then, you know, you went past. I remember being near one of those when I was doing the recording.
Yeah.
A big green sort of semi-tropical plant looking leaves, you know.
And you mentioned you got to know Jules Baker.
Yeah, well, he because there was the big pond in front, and they had this idea of having this sea monster, which he made, because he did all things in latex rubber. He did lots. He did monsters for Doctor Who.
Yeah.
They had this idea of this sea monster was going to come out of the pond in front of the stage in echoes, wasn't it? And I think they had trouble for rising to the surface.
Yeah.
And I said, when I met him, he a year later or whatever, he said it was so embarrassing. You know, he's having to work again. It was something he'd never done before, probably.
Perhaps, yeah.
He thought it would work
do it live
theory,
in front
but
of.
Then, and I think it did. I remember seeing the thing. I thought, what's that supposed to be? These things, tubes coming out of it and stuff. I think
squib.
He got some sort of idea, but that day, the day was a sort of had a disastrous atmosphere in some ways with the rain to begin with. We wondered if the thing would be cancelled, you see.
Yeah.
If it had gone on and on, they might have had to cancel it, because especially electrical equipment,
dangerous.
Sometimes it's not safe to play, is it?
Somebody else taped it as well, and you can hear their tape. Heavy rain that was going on there. I think they're underneath an umbrella trying to protect their equipment.
It did rain slightly here and there.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't quite, obviously the heaviest was at the beginning, but it was, you know, it was like in odd showers, you know, so it was sort of, but we managed to get through it. And as soon as they finished and cleared off very quickly, just it rained again. But
did you take some photographs at Crystal Palace?
I didn't know that one.
No.
But I think it was they were very far away. I may have taken a camera, because they weren't that exciting, were they, to take photos of generally, especially not from a distance. And as I say, there wouldn't be something spectacular to take photos of. If you could be very close, there was something to take photos of.
Had you moved on from your original SLR by this stage? Or were you still using the same one?
I had a Pentax Spotomatic by then.
Yeah.
By the time I was at art school, because I got a reasonable grant. And so I could afford one. And I learned how to do, they taught you how to use darkroom properly and all that. And then a full-time guy that specialised in photography. So I learned a bit more. So I was better in photography in a way. I should have taken more, shouldn't I? But I should probably needed a telephoto lens. Again, it would have been expensive at the time, probably. But
so whenabouts would you have got the Pentax? Thinking
I bought
about
it
your
new. I think I've still got the
1970.
I had it stolen in the end about 3 years later, but the actual one. But I think I've still got the brochure somewhere.
Was it
Pentax? Well, the instruction manual. Rather.
Pentax a 1970 purchase, or
it was a
did you buy it in 1970? The Pentax.
Oh yeah, at the time it was new. Yeah, brand in a new box.
That That was
I might even have the box somewhere.
Interesting.
Possibly. Well, I kept something else in it. I don't know, but I certainly got the instruction manual, you know.
So, we've nearly reached the end. We're now in Bradford.
Yeah, because I changed art colleges,
You moved up north.
Yeah, because I would have liked to stay in London, but as I was probably alluded to earlier on, that I was doing I still wanted to do video moving images. Don't you know, hence my connection with the Pink Floyd. I was quite serious.
Yes.
I would have, if I'd been a little bit more adept in the equipment, that I would have pushed a bit more.
Yeah.
And I must say, it's ironic because I was in a group subsequently, I must say this, you know, in Coombe Transmissions, towards the end.
Which was happening there.
Peter Christopherson joined, and of course he worked for Hypnosis. Mm. He did Wish You Were Here.
Yeah, everything's and by linked, then isn't it?
That combination of connections was like a dream come true in a way, but I'd sort of moved on by then. I was thinking of doing something different. It's difficult to imagine, isn't it, now?
Yeah.
But I did have a sort of connection with them. In fact, incidentally, that my grandparents were on one of their LP covers.
Oh, wow.
By chance, as well.
Yeah.
With Edgar Broughton LP cover.
Really?
Inside Out. So that's another story in itself. But as I say, I wanted to go on and do sort of learn more about how to use video equipment. I was interested in computer graphics before they really existed in any proper way. And so the only course wasn't going to do sculpture or painting, I had to look for a course that was, and there was the only other thing I could vaguely find that might be any good. So I thought I must have another go and for another year, maybe something will come out. Was this course up north in Bradford?
Yeah.
Bradford Regional College of Art, and it was in film, theatre and TV. And of course I got in easily because I was coming from quite a major London art college.
Yes.
And but the trouble was there was not much of course to talk about, really. I mean, it was very 1960s / 70s.
Yeah, early days.
I'd speak to the lecturers about film, and I knew more than the lecturers. I had to tell them what I was talking about.
Yeah.
Let alone be able to give me, you know, I wanted to learn lots of technical information and things. That's what you want to know. And I wanted loads of film stock and video, you know, but they were a bit under-resourced. Mm. But basically, the whole course turned out, it was basically, the guy ahead of it was like a sort of a trendy media figure at the time called Albert Hall. No, not Albert Hunt. It's somebody else.
As in Roy.
Albert Hunt. He was always on Straight Line Nine and things like that. You know, they'd be talking about that. And he was inspired by Bertolt Brecht, you know, political theatre. His most famous thing was the John Ford Cuban Missile Crisis.
Mm.
And I don't think I actually saw that, but he did the Cuban Missile Crisis as a Western film. You know, it was a weird
why not?
Combination. Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, he had this theatre group. So it was basically the theatre group, a lot of members of his theatre group were the lecturers on his course. So it was just like a vehicle to give them a wage so they could be in his theatre group.
Right.
So it didn't work out, but it did work out in some ways because that's where I met Coombe and stuff. But I worked with Bruce Lacey there as well, you see. So there was another connection.
Yeah.
You know, how things went.
And things were moving on for you at that stage with Pink Floyd as well.
You were
losing interest.
Well, that was all part of it because I was quite creative about stuff, a lot of my own ideas. I felt that they were getting a bit more, they got stuck in a rut in a way. And I saw them when because I'd only been at the college for about 3 weeks, and I said, the Pink Floyd are playing. I think, well, I've always been such a big fan, over the years, although I'm getting a bit uncomfortable, if you like. You know, I'm not sort of completely in sympathy. I wish they were doing things a little bit more challenging or whatever, a bit more, you know, sort of, I would say, creative in a different way. But I went to see them, nevertheless, because I thought I can't have them on my doorstep and not go and see them.
No film, photographs, well, I wasn't or audio. That,
you know, I'm still, I'll go out of loyalty, really, you know, from the past,
just to
see it on my doorstep. and I went and they played the, and it was a little bit tight. Well, maybe that's my perspective.
Yeah.
I felt it was a bit, they were going through the, they've been playing more or less the same set for
2 hour concert.
4 or 5 years, you know. Mm. Maybe they've a few new things in here and there, but it hadn't changed a lot. And I just thought, well, I've seen this sort of before. And I was looking for some, you know, obviously I wanted to do these visual things, but I also wanted, you know, I was open-minded. I liked something that was a bit more potential, had more potential, that had a bit more energy.
Something fresh, yeah, I think you're describing.
Well, also, they were becoming slowly becoming the establishment, I felt.
Yes.
You know, don't forget, when they started, they were, as I said, it was almost like punk energy in a way, of with the Sid, you know.
Yes.
And so, and I had, was more sympathy with, I still wanted to rock the boat a bit. I still wanted, yeah. I was about 21 by then.
Yeah, you had youth and energy.
Yeah, I still want, I didn't want to be, sit like there with, you know, in a more sedate sort of way. And I was getting disappointed. I felt in some ways they were using, some of their music was getting a bit cliched, you know. Mm. They do certain riffs, you know, they do certain things. And as I said, my own interests at the time were a bit more attracted to avant-garde, more anarchistic, more experimental things, you know.
Mm.
And that's how I sort of fell out of love at the time. Mm. But I sort of I never stopped listening to Sid, by the way. I'd have to...
No.
He never really. I did. And I've still got the, as you see, the albums.
Yeah, you got the albums there,
which I had.
Excellent condition.
That's a parallel story because I bought those when as they went along, and even that was 70, of course. You know them.
Yeah.
And I, you know, maybe I like in everything you go through phases, but I kept an eye on my Barrett albums, and I always felt. He also meant a lot to me. I think he inspired the Pink Floyd, but he also inspired me as a sort of artistic sort of example, if you about how you can be
self-expression.
You know, keep pushing the boundaries. I think he naturally wanted to do that himself because they say even when he was in the Floyd, he talked about getting 4 girl saxophonists and things like that. And they think, oh, he's gone crazy, he's gone mad. But they did actually get saxophonists.
They did,
and,
yeah. He was backing singers.
Because he'd done that. Let's do something different. And I was very much in the same way, even the way I was responding to them, you know, the other way. I thought, well, you've done that. Why are you doing more of that? You could do something a little bit more, you know, shaking the dice a bit more and another throw of the dice, you know. And so then I got involved with it was all the same month, actually, wasn't it?
Mm.
I met Coombe for the first time as well.
Yeah, and...
Yeah, one door shuts, another one opens, you know. It was like, it was all written, as they say sometimes, you know, in a way. And then I went, and then I found myself not doing any sound either for a while. It became performance. But then I hadn't really ever done that before. So in a way, that was quite engaging and interesting because you felt you were on new territory that hadn't been done before, you know. And that was quite a refreshing and stimulating thing, you know.
And this has been a hugely stimulating conversation.
You haven't fallen
asleep,
then.
My goodness. No, I'm bright-eyed. I could go on and do the whole thing again, but I'm not sure your voice could. That might be a bit of an ask. I think we're done. I think we've done it all.
That was very kind of you to say. Well, I still feel very enthusiastic about the
early
days. Well,
you've definitely got that across. I mean, it's been absolutely fascinating. And I feel like I've been there, which is what we all want.
Oh, yeah,
nowadays.
Well, I hope so.
Especially those of us
we
couldn't be there at the time, but we want to know those stories, and we've just captured yours, and that will now live on, which is exactly what we want to do with this podcast series, is speak to people like you. You are rather exceptional, so there won't be many like you, but it's been great.
Oh, yeah, but it's surprising, isn't it, that you could be one of the survivors that remembers, even as a member of an audience, let alone... collaborators, etc.
We've never met anybody who has quite the same memories as you or anything comparable. We've got people who know things from later years because they came to it a bit later. But you were there at the beginning.
Yeah, well, I mean,
before the beginning with that poster.
It was almost like, as I say, it was a real sort of a passion and life-changing thing. As you can see, as I've tried to express, it affected my life.
Almost.
And I still have interest. I'm still thinking about how the Pink Floyd and Sid were and what drove them, and you know what they did, how it worked, and you know themes and what they didn't do, and all of that still interests me even all these years later.
And it was nearly precisely 5 years of your life, wasn't it, from October 66 when you first saw that poster in Chelsea, and October 71 when you said, that's it.
But that was before they became really famous as well, wasn't it?
They rose, they fell, they rose, they fell. Is your story ultimately, isn't it?
Yeah, I suppose. I mean, I sort of come back, and I appreciate the later stuff in a different way. But I regard them as different bands. These the three phases are very definitely defined areas of. There's a lot of difference, isn't there? There's things obviously in common, I think that you can take them in a different.
They're different things to different people, aren't they? But that's been brilliant.
Oh, right.
I think I'd better press the stop button and see how long we've recorded for. I think it's quite a while. 3 hours and 41 minutes before the edit. That's brilliant.
If they want to go to sleep, they'll get...
I don't think they'll be doing that.
Well, you can chop things about and things.
We'll do a little edit, but not much. Thank you. I'm pressing stop now.